Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway and this edition is published in the early hours of Friday the 19th of June. Our main stories. The US Supreme Court overturns a key part of President Trump's hardline immigration strategy. Facebook says it's removed Trump campaign adverts that used Nazi symbols. And China is reported to have released 10 Indian soldiers 3 days after a brutal border clash. Also in the podcast...
J'invite tous les Français qui veulent rester libres à m'écouter et à me suivre.
80 years on, we remember one of radio's most famous broadcasts, a wartime call for resistance. But we begin, as so many news stories do these days, with a tweet from Donald Trump. Do you get the impression that the Supreme Court doesn't like me? The US president was responding to a ruling that overturned his decision to cancel Obama-era protection for some young immigrants. He had another setback later in the day when Facebook removed some of his election adverts for apparently using a Nazi hate symbol. But it is the Supreme Court ruling that's likely to prove more significant, not least for the nearly 700,000 migrants brought to the US illegally as children who will once again be protected by the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program.
I've had DACA since I was 15, 16 years old. It's allowed me to go to college. It's allowed me to get a full-time job. That could have all been stripped away had the court decided differently today.
But another dreamer and campaigner, Itziri Gonzalez, says her battle is not over.
Definitely a mix of emotions. First, this is a great win. You know, over the course of 2 decades, immigrant activists have paved the way for this win today. But by the same token, gives Trump kind of that ammunition to now know, okay, well, we didn't end this program lawfully, so now let's kind of go back to the drawing board and figure out how to do it.
For more on what the court decision means, I spoke to the BBC's Anthony Zerker in Washington.
The people who were covered by this DACA program that was instituted during the Obama administration are going to keep their protections. These were people who came into the United States without proper documentation as children, and under the Obama administration, they had been granted normalized immigration status, at least on a temporary basis, so they could get jobs, they could collect Social Security and other government benefits, they could go to college, they could take out loans, all those sorts of things, because the Congress, which would pass immigration laws, they weren't able to agree on immigration reform. Obama had pretty much stepped in and done this unilaterally as an executive order. Now, what happened when Donald Trump became president is that they began to try to roll back this program, to undo it. What the court said Thursday was that the way the Trump administration had gone through trying to end the program violated federal law, 1940-something, a law called the Administrative Procedures Act, which set out how administrative rules like the DACA order could be changed and implemented. So essentially, it's a technicality that buys the DACA recipients a little bit of time, perhaps, and puts the ball back into Donald Trump's court or in Congress's hands to try to come up with some sort of a permanent solution.
Meanwhile, the president and the vice president have also fallen foul of Facebook for running ads that contained a Nazi symbol. How important is that?
That's interesting. I mean, this is yet another example of the Trump campaign butting heads with a social media company. Facebook saying that, I think it was 88 advertisements by the Trump for President campaign included this upside down red triangle, which they said they had received complaints about being tied to World War II Nazi Germany, that the Nazis had used this symbol to mark political dissidents, political prisoners. So Facebook decided to take this down. It's the first time Facebook has really taken a stand against the Trump campaign for something they've done. The founder of Facebook said that he didn't want Facebook to get involved in policing speech. Well, here they are now getting into a fight with the Trump campaign. So it'll be interesting to see what the Trump campaign does in response. They've said that these red triangles, they're the symbol of Antifa, not the symbol used by the Nazi parties, and that is very common Although I will say there isn't a whole lot of evidence that it is a symbol of Antifa, which raises the questions of why they used it.
Anthony Zerka in Washington. In a matter of weeks, the number of medical staff dying of COVID-19 in Russia has leapt from around 100 to almost 500. The new unofficial total was revealed by the head of Russia's health watchdog, Alla Samoylova. She also said many of those deaths could have been prevented if Russia had more PPE, personal protective equipment. Oleg Boldarev reports.
Speaking at the medical conference, the head of Rosdravnadzor, Alla Samoylova, said that 489 Russian medics had died in the course of pandemic. Later, the watchdog told BBC that Samoylova had simply quoted a figure which is circulating on social media. Memorial lists, which appeared online, are compiled by dead medics' colleagues, and they may point to the true cost of this epidemic. Non-government experts believe that corrected for average mortality among medics worldwide, the overall death toll from COVID could be 3 to 4 times higher than the Russian official figure of 7,660.
Oleg Boldarev. The British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab has been criticised after he said that taking the knee, the symbol of the Black Lives Matter movement, came from the hit TV series Game of Thrones. A senior figure in the opposition Labour Party here, David Lammy, accused Mr Raab of insulting black people. The Foreign Secretary was speaking to Talk Radio.
Do you know what? I understand this sense of frustration and restlessness which is driving the Black Lives Matter movement. I've got to say on this taking the knee thing, which I don't know, maybe it's got a broader history, but seems to be taken from the Game of Thrones, feels to me like a symbol of subjugation and subordination rather than one of liberation and emancipation. But I understand people feel differently about it, so it's a matter of personal choice.
So would you or wouldn't you do it?
Take the knee for two people, the Queen and the Mrs. when I asked her to marry me.
Well, we'll hear more about where the protest originated in a moment. But first, how damaging is this? Our political correspondent is Rob Watson.
I think it's hugely embarrassing, not just for Mr. Raab, but for the government as well. Embarrassing for Mr. Raab because he is the UK's foreign secretary. He is the UK's most senior statesman. And I think the general feeling in British politics and beyond is that he just got the tone wrong. And for someone who's supposed to be foreign secretary, he didn't seem to appreciate the way in which the global Black Lives Matter movement was working and the sentiment behind it. And it's also embarrassing for the British government because earlier this week, in response to the Black Lives Matter campaign here in the UK and of course overseas, the British government set up a commission on racial equality, and there was a sort of feeling then that it was all sort of last minute, done on a bit of old paper rather than pretty well thought out. And I think Mr. Raab's comments will sort of feed into that scepticism about the government's good intentions. There is a view that if the government is struggling with issues like this, not that they're easy issues, but issues about kind of culture and about values, I think there is concern in government, in the governing Conservative Party and beyond, well, if they are struggling with this, what are they going to do when there's mass unemployment, if there is, as economists are predicting? So a sort of sense that, you know, this government is struggling and may face even tougher challenges ahead.
Rob Watson. The civil rights leader Martin Luther King took a knee during a march in Alabama in 1965, but the current incarnation of the protest stems from a symbolic act on an American football field 4 years ago, as James Robbins reports.
In the modern context of protests under the banner Black Lives Matter, the origins of the symbolic act of going down on one knee or taking the knee are not hard to trace. The phenomenon links back to the gesture by the American football star Colin Kaepernick. In 2016, as quarterback for the San Francisco 49ers, he refused to stand for the playing of the national anthem in protest at what he called a country that oppresses black people and people of color. Initially, the 49ers management upheld his right, citing American principles including freedom of religion and freedom of expression. But once taking the knee became far more widespread at football games, there was a backlash. President Trump denounced players who did it, and the gesture became less personal, more political. The National Football League first banned taking the knee on field, but they have reversed that decision in recent weeks. No one suggests Colin Kaepernick was the first person in history to go down on one knee, but it's the context which is key. Now hundreds of thousands of people are using the gesture, knowing it's a powerful visual signal of protest against racial discrimination and injustice.
James Robbins. It's one of the most famous BBC radio broadcasts in history, but it almost didn't happen. 80 years ago, French army officer Charles de Gaulle turned up at the BBC here in London and, after some confusion, delivered an address to his compatriots back in France, calling on them to resist the Nazi occupation. The current French president, Emmanuel Macron, has visited London to commemorate the anniversary. Our diplomatic correspondent, James Landale, takes up the story.
Now, here is a statement in French of great importance to our French listeners by General de Gaulle.
It's June the 18th, 1940, and France has fallen to the Nazis. A little-known French officer has fled to London and managed to get himself in front of a BBC microphone.
J'invite tous les Français qui veulent rester libres à m'écouter et à me suivre.
Charles de Gaulle was France's most junior general. He had no authority from his government, which had capitulated to the Nazis, and yet he delivered a passionate call to arms, arguing that France had lost a battle, but not the war.
Vive la France, libre, dans l'honneur et dans l'indépendance.
The flame of French resistance, he said, must not and shall not die.
I'm standing outside No. 4 Carlton Gardens in central London, where Charles de Gaulle made his headquarters for the Free French Forces. There's a rather fetching statue of the great man, and there's also a plaque bearing some of the words he broadcast to the world. And I'm joined by the French ambassador to London, Catherine Colonna. Ambassador, can you tell us, why is this speech so important?
It was a strong message of resistance and a strong message of hope, meaning that there will be a victory over fascism, that Europe and France will be liberated.
He was tall, good-looking, very impressive to go. He always made use of all that and rather frightened people, I think, sort of looked down in the mirror.
Driving Charles de Gaulle around London in those days was a young English woman called Olivia Matthews.
They used to say, take us to so-and-so and that sort of thing. And funny enough, I was fairly good at it.
That was because Olivia, aged just 21, had been driving an ambulance for the French army, for which she was awarded the Croix de Guerre. Olivia Jordan, as she now is 101. And she told me her memories of de Gaulle from those heady days in June 1940.
I think he was a very good figurehead, but he was no good at organising it himself. I think his wife was rather better than him. She was sweet.
The extraordinary thing is that de Gaulle's June 18 broadcast almost never happened. The cabinet was opposed. Winston Churchill had to overrule them. And even then, no one told the BBC the general was on his way.
He appeared unannounced and unheralded shortly before, I think, the 9 o'clock news, expecting to broadcast.
Elizabeth Barker, at the time a young BBC producer, was interviewed for the BBC Oral History Collection in 1983.
By this time, we'd had instructions that we were not to put him on the air unless both the Foreign Office and the Ministry of Information had said OK. Well, that was I downstairs having to tell the General that we could not put him on the air until we had got an OK from the highest British authority.
After some hurried telephone calls, permission was finally granted by an official at the Ministry of Information, and an impatient de Gaulle was allowed on air.
Commande à tous les Français libres de continuer le combat.
Few heard that first speech. Indeed, the BBC did not even record it. But de Gaulle repeated different versions in coming days, and newspapers printed the text.
James Landau. And still to come in the podcast, speak to a Kenyan-born musician in Minneapolis about living in the city where George Floyd was killed. Reports from the media in India say China has released 10 Indian soldiers. It follows the brutal clash that resulted in the killing of 20 Indian troops in the Himalayas. Andrasan Etirajan has the latest.
According to the reports, 10 Indian soldiers were released by the Chinese side following 2 days of negotiations between senior commanders in the Ladakh region. Earlier, the Indian Army said no soldiers had gone missing in action. Now that it's clear that frontline Indian troops were captured, the Indian government and the army will be under pressure to explain what went wrong on Monday night. China says Indian soldiers trespassed into its territory, triggering the clash. Indian officials said its soldiers were attacked with stones and clubs studded with nails. There are no casualty figures available from the Chinese side.
Ambassador Etty Rajan. Britain's contact tracing app was supposed to have been rolled out across England by mid-May. But after weeks of development, the government has decided to abandon it. The Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, said it didn't work properly on iPhones. And so the government will try a new approach based on technology provided by Apple and Google.
What matters is what works, because what works will save lives. And I will work with anyone, public or private sector, here or overseas, to gain any inch of ground against this disease. So we've agreed to join forces with Google and Apple to bring the best bits of both systems together.
The British Health Secretary, Matt Hancock. Although many countries have waited until they've got the virus under control before lifting lockdowns, others have pressed ahead even as infections continue to rise. One such nation is South Africa. It has the worst outbreak in Africa, and in the past week alone, new cases there are up by more than a third. But President Cyril Ramaphosa has announced that more sectors of the economy will reopen.
From the outset, we knew that extreme measures were needed to slow community transmission. But we also knew that a nationwide lockdown could not be sustained indefinitely or forever. With a move to alert level 3 from the 1st of June, our prevention response is now largely focused on the simple everyday things that each of us can do to protect ourselves and our communities.
I heard more about the new strategy from our Africa business correspondent, Vumani Mngize, in Johannesburg.
So, Ali, we're going to be seeing a number of businesses and sectors being allowed to reopen under level 3 of lockdown restrictions here in South Africa, such as hairdressers and barbers are going to be allowed to open their shops. Hotels are going to be allowed to open as well. Restaurants as well, you can go and have a sit-down meal at a restaurant. Prior to that, you could only buy your food from a restaurant via delivery. So we're going to be seeing those sectors of the economy being reopened again. It comes at a time when South Africa's infections are rising rapidly. Very concerningly, we're only a few thousand cases behind China, which stands at about 83,000, and South Africa is well above 80,000 at the moment. So it's really concerning for many health experts to see this rise in numbers of infections.
Yeah, South Africa was praised for its early lockdown. Why is the president taking this measure of lifting the restrictions while these cases rise?
It seems the pressure on the economy has been very, very tough. And it seems that the lobbies have somehow won over the president in terms of reopening the economy. So South Africa's economy coming into the COVID pandemic wasn't doing very well at all. We were actually in a recession. And the COVID pandemic has actually exacerbated South Africa's perilous economic situation as is. We stand to reduce our GDP by over 6%. And that's just a conservative figure. So that could be much more. And job losses are rampant in so many sectors. Just yesterday, we saw Edcon, which is one of South Africa's largest clothing providers and has so many stores around the country, having to retrench around 20,000 people. Many mining companies as well are retrenching. And the South African Broadcasting Corporation today just announced that it is also instituting retrenchments at the organization. So the economy isn't doing very well at all. And so the president had to weigh that up in terms of whether to open up the other sectors as well.
Now, we have seen some controls lifted already, including the ban on alcohol, which was rescinded on the 1st of June. Is the increase in cases related to that earlier relaxation?
Yes, that's what many health experts are stating. The ban on alcohol sales was lifted on the 1st of June. And since then, the cases have skyrocketed. And we've also seen the cases of murder also skyrocket. We've also seen cases of gender-based violence also skyrocket. And yesterday, President Cyril Ramaphosa, in his address, mentioned that South Africa's relationship with alcohol needs to be re-examined.
The BBC's Vumani Mngize in Johannesburg. For the past 5 years, asylum seekers arriving in Hungary after travelling through the Balkans have been placed in two transit zones, container camps surrounded by razor wire built into the border fence. Last month, the European Court of Justice ruled that these amounted to places of detention, and so now the camps have been emptied. Nick Thorpe reports on what happens next.
I'm standing outside the refugee reception centre in Balasagyarmat in northern Hungary. This is one of two places where people from the transit zones were brought when they were finally allowed to leave there after the European court ruling.
I know he so like ice cream, but I cannot bite. After I come, every day we eat ice cream.
Abuzar Soltani and his 11-year-old son, Armin, from Iran, were kept in the transit zone from December 2018 to May 2020. Their application for asylum, then their appeal, were both rejected, and they were placed in the pre-deportation area of the transit zone. It was their case and that of another Afghan family, which went all the way to the European Court in Luxembourg, where they finally won. András Lederer of the Hungarian Helsinki Committee, the human rights group which represented the two families in court.
The fact that there are no longer anyone detained unlawfully for an indefinite time in these metal containers is, of course, something we are very, very happy about. But for us, the key concern remains the same. How the government is going to ensure access to the asylum procedure of those people who are in need.
Under the new Hungarian decree, the only way to get into the country to apply for asylum will be to submit a letter of intention at a Hungarian embassy abroad. Only if that letter is approved will the person be allowed to travel to Hungary to launch an application for asylum. There are thought to be several thousand asylum seekers in Serbia hoping to come to Hungary. Erno Simon, spokesman of the UN Refugee Agency, is concerned that the country has introduced a new layer of bureaucracy, which will stop almost anyone applying.
This measure was an opportunity for Hungary to bring its asylum policies and practices in line with the international and the EU law. And we think that it is very important for Hungary to continue to grant access to the asylum procedure in the country for all the people who flee war, flee violence, flee persecution in their home countries.
So does Hungary still have a refugee policy at all? Or is the aim to simply keep everyone out? Questions I put to Zoltán Kovács, Hungarian government spokesman.
No interpretation in our perception of international law would allow people travelling through dozens of countries from all over the world to come to the Hungarian border to apply for asylum because they violate all the standards of international law in the meanwhile. And since the decision of the European Court would have made the transit zone a loophole on the legal system, we decided that, yes, we are going to close it.
Back in the pizzeria in Balasagyarmat, Abuzar and Armin are trying to plan their next move. Abuzar compares the coronavirus lockdown to his own predicament, locked in for the past 17 months.
I'm so happy I come to outside. I can see you and I can see building, car, because in the jail I don't see nothing.
That was Soltani ending that report from Hungary by Nick Thorpe. Let's end the podcast with some music from the Grammy-nominated musician J.S. Ondara.
He was just an American dream. He was just an American dream.
Yeah. The Kenyan-born musician moved to Minneapolis in 2013. The city became infamous last month after George Floyd was killed there by a white police officer. Just before that incident, J.S. Ondara had released an album dealing with the catastrophe of the coronavirus outbreak. He told my colleague Tim Franks about his experience of living in the U.S. at this tumultuous time and his observations of racism there.
I've observed it a lot and I've experienced certain elements of it. There is a certain distrust between the black community and the police system, and it's something of a vicious cycle that just sort of keeps digging itself in. And it's just a cultural thing, I think, within the police culture that's quite terrible and has been so for a very long time. And the experience of being a black person in America is, you know, it's synonymous, regardless of where you're from, regardless of whether you're an immigrant or not. I mean, I didn't grow up here, so where I'm from, certain aspects of this American manufactured racism are pretty alien to me, but still as a resident of America, I get to experience them just because of the color of my skin and stuff like that.
So you were always interested in American music, which presumably also was one of the reasons why you were attracted to the idea of coming to live in the States 7 years ago. What has been your experience compared to perhaps what your expectations were?
The sort of contrast between the idea of the American dream and the reality of what America is was essentially the premise of my first record. I was just a kid with a dream. I was a romantic, and I moved to Minnesota because I just discovered that that's where Bob Dylan was from. That sort of innocence of thought in some way made me blind to some things because I was just focused on why I came to America. I think I've certainly experienced the same troubles that other Black people who live in America do experience. I'm hoping for better times in the future. And I do think things are going to get better as well.
Jess Ondara talking to Tim Franks. And that is all from us for now. There'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, email globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.
This podcast is brought to you by Uma. If you're a small business owner, now more than ever, you understand the importance of being able to adapt so you can always be there for your customers. Uma Office is a cloud-based business phone service that gives small business owners the flexibility needed to run a business efficiently from anywhere. With features like mobile and desktop apps, a virtual receptionist, and call recording, you can do more for less. Uma Office starts at $19.95 per user per month with no contracts. To learn more, go to uma.com or call 833-TRY-OOMA.